You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 10th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, broadcasting to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. Coming up on today's programme, millions voted in South Korea's elections for a new 300-member parliament. We'll hear the early exit poll results. We'll head to Greece, where the Delphi Economic Forum kicks off today. And after a South African court ruled that former President Jacob Zuma can run for office in the country's upcoming general election, we'll unpack what's at stake in the contest. Monocle's Grace Charlton is here to tell us about Milan Design Week and the new issue of the Monocle Salone newspaper. What can we look forward to, Grace?
We'll be talking about which fashion houses have the best cocktail parties and what we can expect from David Lynch's Thinking Rooms.
More from Grace later on, and and we'll finish the show in Florida with the latest from the Miami Film Festival. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Georgina Godwin. South Korea went to the polls today to vote for a new parliament in what's widely seen as a midterm referendum on President Yoon Suk-yeol's administration. Well, I'm joined now from Seoul by Bruno Kaufmann, who's a global democracy correspondent at the Swiss Broadcasting Company. Bruno, many thanks for joining us on the show. What do we know of the results so far?
Yes, I mean, the final results are still to be announced by the Korean National Election Commission, and the vote counting is underway since 2 hours ago when the polls closed. But what can be projected and has been projected by all major TV networks is another landslide victory for the main opposition party. The Democratic Party, which could win almost two-thirds of the seats in the National Assembly. And on the other side, the Conservative Party of the sitting president, Yoon Suk-yeol, is doing very badly and could even get less than the 103 seats as it won at the last election.
So what do you think is driving this result?
Yes, I mean, it has, as you have said, I mean, this has been as a referendum on the sitting president, which won with a slight majority 2 years ago. And this former state prosecutor had little political experience, and he has really been doing very badly with the Koreans, with his hardcore law and order policies. And this has resonated not with this kind of needs most people here in Korea have when it comes to house pricing, even food pricing. And that maybe the most symbolic story was in the recent weeks that the president went to a food store and said that the green onions are very good priced in this store, which was obviously not the true price. And he angered very much both producers and consumers and the public with this.
So how do you think this electoral change might affect South Korea's policymaking in the future?
I mean, it will continue this kind of very hard confrontation between the parliament and the president, and there is little room for compromise because polarization has been a feature of Korean politics for a long time, and it will now a little bit also depend if the opposition could make it over the very important 200 seats mark, because then the opposition would have the right to override the veto power of the president, and he could implement legislation and he could even impeach the president. So until now we had a blockade, and this blockade could continue because the president of course also have veto powers as long as the opposition doesn't get more than 200 seats.
I just want to unpack what you said there about polarization. I wonder if you could describe the demographic landscape and who the people are that are driving this divide.
Yes, that's a very interesting question. And in recent days, I was really talking to many people here in South Korea. And most people, independently what they're voting for, they told me about that they're very unhappy about the political atmosphere, about the spiteful tone in the public debate. And it's especially many young people, female voters in the big cities, who feel very uncomfortable in this kind of political atmosphere, which still feels very paternalistic and hierarchical. While on the other side, of course, Korea is a super modern, innovative country. So there's a clash of cultures, there's a clash of attitudes, and this has been now expressed in today's vote.
And what do you think this might mean for South Korea's foreign policy?
I think there will not be an immediate change of that, because, of course, the president, he has a prerogative for the foreign policy, and the current administration under President Yoon Suk-yeol, he's very much leaning towards the United States and against the autocratic leadership of the North. So there has been a big tension between that. While you can say that today's result is also a message from the electorate that there should be a more conversational approach again. And even from Japan and from Washington, we have heard such signals. So it could be that this will, in a way, soften a little bit the stance towards the North and also towards China in one way. But at the same time, we can also see that it will take another 3 years until the next presidential election, where the current opposition leader, which won today a big result, Lee Jae-myung, who lost the election last time, he could be the new president. And he would then, of course, have another stance as the current administration.
And so what happens to Yoon Suk-yeol in the interim?
I mean, the big issue is, of course, if he will be at all able to achieve something, because he has really lost a lot of the trust. Even the current conservative leadership tried to distance themselves from the president. So it's a big, big risk that we will see a very lame duck presidency in the next years with him.
And Bruno, what is the atmosphere there like at the moment? Are people celebrating what is presumed to be the result?
No, there's very little celebration. I mean, because this vote has been very much about which side is hating the others more. So there is little celebration. There's little relief, because everybody knows that with this result, there will be no real solutions for the next years. It will be very hard to find compromise, to find solutions. And that was what most people here in South Korea would have wished for.
Bruno, thank you very much indeed. That was Bruno Kaufmann from Seoul. Now, here's Laura Kramer with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Georgina. Iran's supreme leader has said Israel must be punished for attacking the Iranian embassy in Syria. In a major escalation of Israel's war within the region, suspected Israeli warplanes bombed Iran's consulate in Damascus, killing 7 military advisors. The U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan has warned that more joint patrols can be expected in the South China Sea following drills by the U.S., Australia, Philippines, and Japan last weekend. The statement comes ahead of meetings in Washington this week between President Joe Biden and the leaders of Japan and the Philippines, where they will discuss ways to push back against China. And Liberia's Senate has approved the creation of a war crimes court, which will be bringing overdue justice to the victims of serious abuses committed during the country's two civil wars. Around 25,000 people are believed to have been killed in the conflicts. The resolution has been welcomed by activists who have long called for accountability. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Georgina.
Thanks, Laura. The Delphi Economic Forum annual conference is on right now in the ancient city of Delphi, gathering top leaders from across sectors in an effort to spark dialogue, inspire change, and transform conversation into action. Our Andrew Muller is there and joins me now. Andrew, can you give us an overview of the event?
It's one of the many diplomatic and or security and or economic forums that occur all over Europe. I suspect if you were determined to, you could spend your life literally bouncing from one to the other. But its obvious focus, given our location here, is on Greece, but also the Mediterranean region and the Balkan region just to the north. And there's obviously never a shortage of talking points from either of those. But this year, the talking points, I suspect, for obvious reasons, are more prolific than usual.
Mm. What does it actually hope to accomplish? Are there specific goals?
The specific goals are it's all the stuff you said. It is the fostering of dialogue and connecting of people. But I think the Delphi especially, and this is the ninth version of it, there's a big desire to put Greece back on the map. So this was launched 9 years ago at a time when Greece was still regarded kind of as Europe's problem child, this sort of difficult little country which had nearly yanked the entire European Union into its largely self-dug hole, but has since turned itself around. And I think the Delphi Economic Forum very much wanted to be part of that process by, you know, putting Greece at the hub of events. And the location is obviously extremely significant. We are just down the hill here from ancient Delphi, where the wise people of eras long past used to come to commune with the Delphic Oracle and ponder the state of the world. So I think they're hoping a bit of that will rub off. But for visiting journalists such as ourselves, one of the great strengths of this event is that because everybody is stuck up hill in the middle of nowhere, no one can actually get away from you. So it's actually quite an easy place to get hold of people.
The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, I understand, has just made the keynote speech. What did he say?
Yeah, he joined by video link from Kyiv. He's not here in person. And it's at this point kind of melancholy watching him because, and I say this with all sympathy, because his argument is still the same argument. You get the sense of a man running out of new ways to keep saying the same thing, which is that he needs more weapons, he needs more ammunition, he needs more money, he needs less equivocal support from Ukraine's allies to help it defend itself and in so doing defend Europe. But we're now more than 2 years into this. He's been saying this for more than 2 years. He's been right to say this for more than 2 years. But I, there's almost a sense of exasperation coming from him at this point, and not without reason.
And who else is there in person?
In person, well, we've already heard the keynote speech from the president of Greece, Katerina Sakellaropoulou. She's the obvious big name at this. The president of Montenegro, Yakov Milatovic, is also about to speak. And Natasha Musa, the president of Slovenia, is also here. I think she's actually speaking behind me just now. But we spoke to her ourselves just earlier. And that will be airing some of that on the Foreign Desk probably the week after next.
And can you give me some key takeaways from that?
Yeah, it was really interesting because we met her for the first time at the Munich Security Conference, not this year, but last year, when she'd only recently got the job. And she has a previous career in being a lawyer and in being a journalist. So it was interesting to talk to her a year and a bit in to figure out what she'd learned on the job. What she's mostly learned, I think, judging from our conversation, is new levels of frustration with the United Nations. Slovenia did get elected as a non-permanent member of the Security Council and is serving there for the 2024-25 term. And yeah, she did articulate quite well that frustration of understanding that the Security Council needs reform to remove some of the power held over it by the permanent five. But obviously, you're going to need to get the permanent five to agree to that, and the chances of that ever happening are remote. But underpinning her frustration, I get the sense that she still has a real belief in the possibilities of the United Nations and the possibilities of the United Nations as a peacekeeper as well as a peacemaker. But this, again, is something that has become more and more difficult now that it becomes less and less common for the P5 to agree on anything.
And what will you and the Foreign Desk team be doing for the remainder of the conference?
Well, we will be scuttling about the venues, trying to talk to more people. We will be speaking to Stefan Lofgren, the former Prime Minister of Sweden, later today. We have various other advisors and ambassadors and ministers coming up. And yeah, this will all be on future episodes of the Foreign Desk and our shows more generally. We're also going to be enjoying the sunshine and the absolutely outstanding food.
I'm sure you will. And sampling a fair bit of the drink too. Andrew Muller, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Yesterday, a South African court agreed that former President Jacob Zuma may run in May's general elections, overturning a decision by electoral authorities barring him over a previous conviction. The country will hold general elections on May the 29th in what's expected to be the most competitive vote since the advent of democracy in 1994. Well, I'm joined now in the studio by Tara O'Connor, who's founder and executive director of Africa Risk Consulting, a Pan-African consulting company. Tara, it's really wonderful to have you here in person.
Great to be here.
Welcome. It's been a rocky road for Jacob Zuma. Remind us of his fall from grace, his beef with the ANC, and what his plans are now.
Well, his fall from grace was really what they call his strategy to actually stay out of jail, because Jacob Zuma, when he came into power as president, he instituted probably the greatest state capture or organized, orchestrated corruption syndrome that Africa has seen, possibly with only the exception of Zimbabwe. And the fall from grace came from what they call the Zondo Commission, which was a commission of inquiry into the said corruption, which still rumbles on. So there are still a number of ANC members who have been implicated in the corruption scandals but haven't yet faced court. And Zuma is one of them.
And now he's said that, of course, he's running for a completely separate party.
Absolutely. And he's taken the name Umkhonto weSizwe for his party, which means Spear of the Nation, which was the ANC armed wing. So it really is an appropriation of ANC symbols and so on. He's formed this party. There doesn't seem to be that much of a manifesto, but observers suspect that it is closely allied to the Economic Freedom Front.
Well, let's look at manifestos, because there are three main parties. What are their manifesto points?
So the three main parties, I mean, the ANC's manifesto is really a repackaging of what it's failed to do in its previous times in government. And let's not forget, the ANC has been in power for 30 years. And so it has, you know, really failed in recent years to deliver to the population. Then you've got the Democratic Alliance, which is a centre-right party, which is more like the old-style British Conservative Party, which is involved, you know, is looking at less state but more pro-business kind of. It's a middle-class party, if you like. And then you've got the radical left, which are Marxist-inspired Economic Freedom Front party members led by the firebrand Julius Malema. And they are really, they define themselves against all the other parties by being very dramatically radical, talking about nationalizing banks, bringing much more state into the economy, nationalization, expropriation, and very much a state involvement in the economy.
Are there any wild cards?
There are wild cards, not just Jacob Zuma's MK party, which looks set to, is now polling third, which is remarkable in the race.
Above the EFF.
Above the EFF, which is quite interesting, and also which makes an alliance between the two of them more likely. Mm. We then have things like Rise Mzanzi, which is looking to poll at least 5% of the elections. And they are, again, a social democrat party, quite interesting, led by the ex-editor of Business Day, and backed by sort of very wealthy South Africans. So much to play for.
Why is this election seen as so consequential?
So it's the first really competitive election that South Africa has seen. After 30 years of ANC dominance, this election really ends that. And it's really what people, observers look at as the real transition. It's a transition away from the Liberation Party that brought freedom to South Africa. And it's such a political trend. We see it in other places, like it's happening at the moment in Namibia, for example, where the population gets fed up of the ruling party and moves away from it and considers something new.
Mm. Why does what happens in South Africa affect the continent?
South Africa fights with Nigeria for being the biggest economy. It is the dominant economy in the region, particularly in the SADC region. You know, you've got Egypt, Nigeria, and South Africa as the important economies. But South Africa It's also a very important member of BRICS. So it's very much allied to Russia, China and India in the South-South type division. But it's very important. It's important just because it's also traditionally seen as a conduit for international investment. So what happens and how the political manifestos form the next government program is very important for foreign investors to watch.
And what do you expect the result to be?
So I expect actually that the ANC will cobble together a coalition, and it will be a coalition of the small and more centrist parties. And that will mean lots of cattle trading over the next few months, which obviously is not great. Coalition politics in general is a necessary democratic evil, but it does mean less delivery, more chaos, and lots of manipulating and political power play.
Tara O'Connor, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Milan Design Week begins on Sunday, and to mark the occasion, Monocle is releasing the annual design-dedicated newspaper Salone de Mobile Special. The deputy editor of that publication, Grace Charlton, joins me now. Grace, I know that you're actually off to Milan today, I think, so let's look at why Salone matters. What are the different parts of the fair, and how do city-based events grow in importance? How have you seen that evolve through the years? Because you've been going for a long time.
It's interesting. I think, well, first of all, there are so many terms related to Milan Design Week and so many different sections of the fair. One of the big roles of the newspaper is actually to make sense of that for people visiting, maybe for the first time. But in the trade hall called Row, there's the actual Salone del Mobile Fair. And then as part of that this year, there's Euro Cucina, which is about bathrooms and kitchens. So that's all separate and in one part of Salone. And then in the city, there are these fun events and installations that have grown in importance so much over the past few years and almost are surpassing the fair itself, which is an interesting development. And there are different regions in the city of Milan that become their own like little neighborhoods for design. So there's a lot going on.
And the publication is kind of essential then to guide you around the event.
I know. Sometimes I feel like I'm speaking a foreign language when I'm explaining this to people. But yeah, we've done our best to really handpick our favourite designers, interesting developments, cool collaborations, and like really fun manufacturing places.
Mm. Now, there's a thing called a Salone Satellite. Tell us about that.
So that's a section of the fair, again, in the trade halls, which is dedicated to under 35-year-olds. It's turning 25 this year. It's been pioneered by this sort of Milanese grand dame of design called Marva Griffin-Wilshire. And I interviewed her for this newspaper as well. And it's just incredible to see all these young designers that have been given a platform and have gone on to do incredible things.
Mm. Now, when we think about Milan Design Week, we think more usually about furniture, actually. But fashion houses are really having a big presence this year.
Yeah, they've really started to make their presence felt. They come in with big budgets, which can be nice, and they host the best cocktail parties. Last year, Andrew Tuck and I got tucked in, if you will, to some champagne flutes at a Louis Vuitton party. This year, I'm looking forward to Loewe. They're releasing lights. Last year, they did a big chair showcase. I think it makes sense for fashion brands to get involved in design. They're both very aesthetic pursuits. And I think it's just an area of the market that they're interested in at the moment. Mm.
Big name from film there too this year.
I know. I mean, it came as a surprise to many, but David Lynch has shown a collection of furniture at Salone at the fair in 1997. So this is actually a homecoming in a way for him. But yeah, he's designed these thinking room installations, and I'm sure it'll be clad in blue velvet.
Of course, yeah. Of course. Grace, what else are you really looking forward to there, and what can we read about in the publication?
Well, in the publication, we try to sort of break it down into events happening in Milan, maybe a new restaurant. There's a little sort of Japanese bakery that we've showcased. So it's not all furniture, I promise. And then we also have like interviews with big CEOs. Last year, the winner of Salone Satellite, who's a Japanese guy who uses tatami material to recycle and create a new, you know, sort of like rubbery green material. We talked to him. So we're trying to have a little bit of a balance. And then we also talk about design events that are happening beyond Milan. For example, I mean, Venice is taking place at the same time this year, which is a little bit controversial. But we're also looking forward to Copenhagen and trying to, like, you know, get a little calendar going.
And of course, Monocle Radio will be very present there.
Yes, we've got our own set up in the House of Switzerland. We'll be having interviews on the hour for about, I think, 4 days or something crazy like that. But yeah, it'll be really fun.
I'm sure it will. And the publication Salone de Mobile Special, that's obviously available at all good newsstands, but it will also be there in situ, if you like, available in Milan.
Exactly. We'll be taking over a kiosk, I'm sure.
Grace Charlton, thank you very much indeed. Have fun.
Thank you.
The 41st Miami Film Festival is on until Sunday. There are more than 180 films from over 30 countries in this year's official selection. Well, I'm joined now by Ruben Rosario, who's film critic for Miami Art Zine, an online publication covering arts and culture for South Florida. Ruben, many thanks for joining us on the show. What's the history of this festival?
Wow, that's quite a question to begin with. Good morning from Miami. How are you?
We're very good. I'm very pleased to be speaking to you there and imagining you under palm trees, thinking about 41 years of a film festival that's just grown and grown in that time.
It has. I moved to Miami in 1995, so the festival had been going on for quite a while, though it was still relatively young. In the 80s and early 90s, it was known as a springboard for international filmmakers to find their way into the U.S. And North America. Filmmakers like Louis Malle and Pedro Almodovar got quite a boost from having their films shown at the festival. It doesn't quite have that clout anymore. And the festival has gone through a lot of ups and downs and changes over the years. This year in particular represents a big change because they have a new executive director. His name is James Woolley. He comes from the Frame Line, the San Francisco Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. This is his first year. He places the emphasis on fun. He wants a fun and lighthearted vibe to the whole event. That's what he brings to the table.
What are the highlights this year?
The highlights this year, it's big, as you can see. More than 180 films, that means it's the biggest lineup in the festival's history. So there are films from all over the place. As always, there is always a spotlight on Latin American film. And what I zeroed in my coverage was films that were made in South Florida, telling stories about Miami, South Floridians in Miami, South Floridians living in South Florida for a long, long time. The highlight, I would say, from those films I've seen is the film that you may have heard of called Mountains, mm-hmm. that won an award at the Independent Spirit Awards a few months ago for its filmmaker, Monica Sorrell, and it's the story of a family, a Haitian-American family who lives in Little Haiti. And through their eyes, we see the phenomenon of gentrification, how their neighborhood is changing. And it's a very touching domestic drama.
What does the film festival do for Florida? Does it change the mood? Is it welcomed by locals?
There is some crossover, but I think it's more of an art community event. There is an outreach to the community at large. I don't think it's as seismic as something like the Wine and Food Festival or Jazz in the Gardens or other bigger festivals. But it does have quite a footprint all the same.
And Ruben, if it comes to an end on Sunday, if there's one thing people should not miss before then, what would you recommend?
There's a few films that I do want to see that I have not seen. Like tonight, there's the world premiere of Naked Ambition. It's a documentary about the photographer and pinup model, Bonnie Yeager, about her life and career. And it's co-directed by Karim Papch, who people may know from the documentary that's from Netflix about the life of a soldier, Walter Mercado, Mucho, Mucho Amor. And this is his new film. So I'm looking forward to that. And on Thursday, I'm seeing the local premiere of Victor Erice's new film, Close Your Eyes. He's the director of The Spirit of the Beehive. And it's his first fiction feature in 3 decades. So I'm looking forward to that.
Ruben, thank you very much indeed. That was Ruben Rosario, and the film festival runs until Sunday. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing, which was produced by Laura Kramer. Our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio manager was Steph Chungu. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.